The 1998 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 154, Mormons, Baptists, and All That, Coping with Religious Diversity, a paper by Peter Appleby and chaired by Floyd Anderson. This is a 60-minute session taped on a 90-minute tape, so the second half of Side 2 will be blank.
I say fortunate simply because to do our presentation for the topic that relates to religion, it relates to the society as a whole, and I think the background that he has is incredibly impressive in terms of the topic at hand. He is in the Department of Philosophy at the University of Utah and has been there since 1965, which now approaches 40 years of service there at the U. He has been chairman of the department from 1990 to 1996. And the topic, as all of you know, is Mormons, Baptists, and All That, Coping with Religious Diversity. And this is a challenge. And as I say, I think one of the really significant aspects of it is that the background that he has includes both theology, it includes philosophy, it includes anthropology, all of which are disciplines which are intricately interrelated to this particular topic. He, for instance, attended in 1959 to 60, on a fellowship, the Episcopal Theological School and the Harvard Divinity School. He got his A.B. degree in 1959 from Hamilton College with a concentration in philosophy and English and French literature. He did his Ph.D. in 1963 at the University of Texas at Austin in philosophy and anthropology. Great background. He also did his dissertation on a critical study of Pierce's philosophical theology. You see this beautiful integration. The areas of research and publication, professional and applied ethics, are areas he's done research in, philosophy of religion, and philosophical theology. He has also had background in areas of teaching which specialized and expanded on this particular training. He's taught the history of philosophy, the history of ideas, existentialism and pragmatism, and the important philosophers of our time and past, Plato, Kant, Hegel, Kierkegaard, Pierce, and Sartre. All of them are very significant philosophers that are certainly the outstanding philosophers in our history. His professional position, which began, as I said, in 1963, was at Southwest Missouri State College as an assistant professor of philosophy. He became an associate professor of philosophy in 1971, and he also became the associate director of the Albert C. and Grace A. Tanner Humanistic Center in 1995. 97 for 2 years. He's had many honors and fellowships, including Phi Beta Kappa, and in the area of philosophy and public speaking. So I think from every point of view, we are indeed fortunate to have Dr. Peter Appleby as our presenter today. After he's presented, we'll try and take some time for questions and discussion. Thank you.
In the hope that the what I have to say today will reflect something of their spirit. I'm not quite sure why I adopted this title, Mormons, Baptists, and All That. The Southern Baptists came to town, and for a little while there was a flap about who are the real Christians. And in fact, I gather that's a topic that's going to be discussed here. I think that for most of us who do not have the missionary's famous intestinal combustion going on, that debate probably seems silly. That for most of us, the idea of God being some sort of cosmic bean counter is not something to be taken seriously. That for most people, it's enough to lead decent, humane lives, trusting somehow or another, probably very unclearly, but somehow or another, in the justice and mercy of the Savior. Americans, by and large, I think, tend to favor what one sociologist calls quiet religion. Quiet religion means that we tend to have our convictions, and we believe that those convictions are correct. But we don't favor imposing them on others, and we don't favor making much of a public noise about those convictions, even though we hold them quite seriously. That's quiet religion, and it seems to be characteristic of a very large majority of people who regard themselves as middle-class Americans. It holds very highly the virtue of tolerance. And I suppose when we confront the more zealous participants in the Baptist Mormon spat, we're sort of inclined to say, why don't you fellows get a life and practice some tolerance? The virtue of tolerance, I think, is importantly backed up by the virtue of humility. And the humility part of this may not be something that most of us have thought about, but it's an elementary logical fact that most religious beliefs, and conceivably all of them, are false. That is true because to the extent that these beliefs conflict with each other, at most one of them will be true. Further, a moment's reflection will show that feeling certain about something is no guarantee of its truth. And so we develop the virtue of humility. Again, most of us, or many of us at any rate, hold our beliefs quite firmly. We believe that they are correct. But we recognize that most of us have got to be wrong. And maybe in addition to tolerance, we have humility. But the situation here is a very peculiar one, because I think it turns out that even though it is true that most and possibly all religious opinions are false, people can be and are logically entitled to hold their own divergent religious beliefs. I suggest this on the basis largely of some work by, in the last couple of decades, by philosophers Alvin Plantinga and William Alston, who've made forceful arguments to the effect that people can be logically, or a little more technical term, epistemically entitled to basic beliefs about the world, and in our case about God, that they happen to hold if those beliefs are appropriately presented to them and fit within the context of their own cultural life worlds. I'm expressing a very technical view here in very crude terms, but perhaps we can talk about it some more later. They have argued that there is no ultimate presupposition-free perspective from which it would be possible to evaluate entire worldviews. And thus they have argued that in general, both religious and non-religious people may hold their views with logical propriety. And here I'm adding something that I don't think they said, but maybe they did. As long as we avoid both unconscionable credulity and unwarranted skepticism. But if we skate between the Scylla and Charybdis of being overly credulous on one side and overly skeptical on the other, we may well be logically entitled to hold whatever, say, religious positions or what's at issue here, we happen to hold. So now we have, again, a very broad picture. The idea that surely it's true that most of us are wrong, but surely it's also true that many of us, perhaps most of us, are basically entitled to hold whatever religious beliefs we actually do hold. So that's the broad sort of logical or epistemic picture as I see it. I want to add a side note here. When I say that people can be or are entitled to hold all kinds of conflicting beliefs about religious matters or any other matter, I don't mean to advocate a kind of epistemological relativism. I think we have to be relativistic with respect to what people are logically entitled to believe, but I reject the idea that there is no such thing as the truth of the matter. I have not been talking about truth at all. In all kinds of circumstances, we may be logically entitled to hold beliefs that are, in fact, inaccurate. We might have very good evidence for them. A simple example. The belief that the sun moves around the earth. That belief, I think, is one that most of us now think is false. But without some sort of sophisticated argument, any fool can see that it's true. All you have to do is get up early enough in the morning, and you can see the sun coming up on one side and stick around for a while. It'll fall into the Salt Lake on the other side, and you'll see that it goes around the earth. So that would be an example, a crude example, of something that is not true, but which one might be entitled to believe. So I'm not, in that sense, a relativist, though I am a relativist with respect to the idea that people can be doing their, what, epistemic duty by believing all kinds of things which conflict with beliefs of others. Now, if we move to the sphere of shared life, of the life of the country, the life of our own community, it seems that for quite a long time, we have lived more or less successfully, depending on where you are in the society, with a posture that I call shallow diversity. That is to say, we have been tolerant of conflicting religious beliefs and practices within quite strict limits. We've had a kind of civic faith in an amorphously Judeo-Christian God. And if you think about that expression for a while, you'll begin to reflect on its real peculiarities. This whole elision of Judaism and Christianity that goes into that notion of Judeo-Christian, I think probably ought to be offensive to anybody who's seriously a Jew or seriously a Christian. But it's the sort of whatever God, a kind of, you know, whatever, Judeo-Christian God. And the system worked well enough as long as everybody acted like a theologically moderate, white, middle-class Protestant Christian. And, of course, we all know that that's how all civilized human beings act, like theologically moderate, white, middle-class Protestants. And in that system of shallow diversity, by and large, minority voices were either ignored or silenced. That is, the serious religious concerns of Jews, of Native Americans, of Mormons, of all kinds of people, were set aside, condescended to, ignored, or in the case particularly of the Native Americans, silenced. We approved a kind of diversity. It was a kind of diversity that made it amusing for us to eat bagels, just like Jews, go down to the reservation and buy cheap imitations of Kachina dolls with which we decorated our living rooms, to watch people performing amusing dances. The whole attitude was one of condescension and showcasing different cultures, a little bit different from our own, and showing that we could be cosmopolitan by eating fry bread. But now we have looming in our civic society, civil society, what I call deep diversity, and that is posing new problems. I think it's the result of the assertion in recent decades, the serious assertion of minority and individual rights. People have been demanding that their concerns and interests be taken seriously in the civil society, and they have succeeded in asserting their rights in many contexts. And we also now have a new wave of immigrants, huge numbers of whom are not European Christians. And if you think about the cultural heritage of the Mormon community, which is a relatively small community in Utah. Who are these people? Well, most of them, Northern Europeans. An awful lot of Englishmen. An awful lot of Scandinavians. This has been, until recently, a relatively homogeneous group. But now, that community, along with lots of others, is changing. And now we are having to confront really basic differences in belief and practice. It's no longer a matter of saying, well, you don't mind eating dairy products with your meat. Somebody else doesn't want to eat dairy products with his meat. You do what you want to do. He can do what he wants to do. When we confront issues like the problem of abortion, the problem of euthanasia, problem of assisted suicide, when we think about people who, for conscientious reasons or for deep cultural reasons, refuse or feel unable to participate in the conventions of our medical system. Let me just give you an example, one that is being confronted by medical people here in a big way. We now are officially committed, very importantly committed, to doctrines about informed consent. People who come for medical treatment must be told what is wrong with them, or what the caregiver thinks is wrong with them, what's going to be done, what the risks and benefits are. If you are a participant in Navajo culture, that is about the worst thing you could imagine doing to somebody. A patient comes in presenting with say, a lump in her breast. Suspicion is that it's a cancer. Thinking about what the risks are of failing to treat that cancer. For an Anglo patient, you tell her what's going on. You must tell her what's going on and what are the treatment options. If you suggest to the Navajo patient that she is in danger of losing her life, what you do is to tear apart the fabric of her whole spiritual life by blasting into what is called the blessing way. And the last thing in the world that you want to do, if you're interested in taking care of a Navajo patient, is to give her news like that. So we now have basic cultural clashes. Arranged marriages for juveniles. Here's a Shiite Muslim refugee family finds itself from Iraq, finds itself winding up in all places in Lincoln, Nebraska. Just try to imagine how that would be. One day you're in rural Iraq, two or three days later, you're in Lincoln, Nebraska. They find that their children, like children all over the world, I suppose, make cultural adjustments very easily. They have a 13 and a 14-year-old daughter, and those girls almost instantly turn into American teenagers. Now, what could be worse for a Shiite Muslim than having a daughter turn into an American teenager? It's hard to imagine what could be worse. So these parents, being responsible people, move to protect their kids. They import husbands for them from New York. One, I think, came from New York, the other Washington. Young men, 22, 23 years old, who were married to these girls. And the upshot of that was that the parents ended up in jail for contributing to the delinquency of minors, and the husbands ended up in jail, too, for statutory rape. The mother of these girls protested in her own defense that, after all, she had been married at the age of 13 in an arranged marriage, and this is what you do to protect your family. If you see these kids getting into trouble, you act appropriately. Well, another subject, female circumcision. Don't need to go into that. That has been in the press. A very drastic practice that is carried out in various places of the world, including Egypt, has been the subject of a good deal of litigation in the United States. The religious use of drugs, religious animal sacrifices, and coming closer to home, religious sensitivities colliding with pot hunters and recreational land users. We've got a case in the pot hunting category right now, the family in downstate Utah who's in trouble for disturbing Indian middens and a burial. So the point is now, we can't anymore just say, well, you know, we're all white Protestants at heart, and we all believe in a Judeo-Christian God, and we'll all say the Pledge of Allegiance and hope this stuff goes away. It won't go away. And so the question is how to cope, how to deal with this. And I'm going to make some quick proposals here and then see what you think. First, it seems to me, obviously, maximum toleration and respect. I think for many years, at least this is true of the cultural milieu in which I developed, we've had an interest in people who are not like ourselves, but it's been rather parallel to the interest that we take in animals in the zoo. We've been sort of amused by the cunning things. Surely some of you remember visiting, say, sun dances or imitations, simulacra of Indian sun dances that were were carried on as though they were carnival entertainments. So I think we've got to combine tolerance with a new kind of respect, presuming the integrity and the seriousness and the intellectual rectitude of other people's beliefs, even when those beliefs are very much unlike our own. From that, we get a principle of interferences only for real cause. That is to say, no serious harm, no foul. And I think that there are obvious cases where intervention is appropriate, and I'll say a little bit about that shortly, but to stay out of other people's business as far as we possibly can, to minimize presumptions of our own sectarian values. Maybe it's all right for us to recite the pledge that says we are one nation under God, and we all know who that God is. But don't push it. Let's not impose too heavily a common worldview that many of us share on those who don't. To learn about the cultures of other people, and here I'm not going to make it long, but I'm going to make it enthusiastic. We need to teach religion in the schools. We urgently need to get into the schools early in competent ways all the way through, teaching our kids how to understand, teaching our kids what other people are like and how to understand them. Then we need to warn newcomers of the limits of toleration. In that Nebraska case that I told you about, the Shiites in Lincoln, the prosecuting attorney said, look, here's how it is. If you live in Nebraska, you're going to obey Nebraska law, period. She was ready to play hardball and did play hardball, in fact. I think there was an element of real intolerance there, but never mind that. I think it's fair enough to say we are not going to tolerate juvenile marriages. I think there's some heat being placed now as a result of this scandalous case of this kid who got beaten up by her father, where we may begin to see some law enforcement in Utah on this matter. And maybe this is a place to draw the line. We say, marriages of juveniles look like child abuse to us, and we won't allow it. My own inclination would be to do the same thing about female circumcision. Say, we simply do not tolerate this in America. And that means that people coming to our country have got to be warned. We don't let them come here, react as their culture would instruct them to do, and then throw them in jail. So this means that where there are limits, and surely there are limits, we've got to warn. Then we've got to learn how to settle the conflicts that we have. Now I'll go back to issues like the abortion and euthanasia issues and the assisted suicide on non-religious grounds. Whatever motivates my position on some issue of public discussion, for instance, on the euthanasia issue, It may be true that I have some religious conviction that bears heavily on that issue. But if you don't share that conviction, then we've got to figure out a way to negotiate that issue on non-religious grounds. And I want to suggest that we have a lot of non-religious grounds. That is, to the extent that we are participants in this common culture, we have a common morality, and we have a very elaborate and substantial system of constitutional and legal tradition, which we can rely on. Now, the common morality that I'm talking about is nothing very exotic. People are fond of pointing out how much diversity there is in our moral convictions, and there is quite a lot. But there are also ordinary, what one writer calls common sense rules of morality that, as far as I know, are absolutely universal. And we can muster the resources of those common understandings to negotiate the issues where we have genuine conflict. Think about that, say, in terms of religious uses of narcotics. There are a lot of Christians that have very, very strong feelings about that, strong convictions about that, because there's been a good deal of controversy about the mystical tradition in Christianity and elsewhere, the use of hallucinogenic drugs to induce what many Christians, not all, but many Christians regard as sort of fraudulent mystical experiences. And our general culture tends to look down upon drug use, at least those that you can't buy from the doctor, as somehow more signs of moral deficiency. But it seems to me that there are fairly straightforward ways in which we could, if we wished, negotiate the question of religious uses of such substances as peyote, in terms of harms to people not involved, in terms of concerns about narcotics addictions and so on. We could negotiate that out, and it should not, as we say nowadays, take a rocket scientist to figure out a way in which people whose convictions involve the use of these drugs can do so without impinging on the lives of others. And then finally, I think we've got to allow very, very generous slack for special cases. And I'll mention two special cases. As you may be aware, we now have in our country a large group of refugees from Cambodia and Thailand, Vietnam. These are Hmong people, that's spelled H-M-O-N-G, who are refugees of the aftermath of the Vietnam War and the horrifying events that have happened in Cambodia since the Vietnam War. These people were turned out of their homes, out of their homelands, and became refugees, largely as a result of actions taken by the United States government. They were more or less forced onto the losing side of that war, and they have been the victims of wholesale slaughter ever since. And tens of thousands of them have been brought to the United States because the alternative for them was death. Now, these people have in some ways thrived in the United States, but they have had real problems with the American medical system. Their native ways of doing things just don't fit with our ways of doing things. And in one case that has been famously written about, there was a long, like, five-year battle between the public health authorities in California and the family of a child with grand mal epilepsy. I think we, in a case like this, we've got to allow absolute maximum latitude for these people to do things the way that they take to be right. The parents of that child ended up being charged with child neglect because they didn't follow the orders that were given to them by the medical people. That should not have happened. And here, there's the matter about warning newcomers about the limits of our toleration. Perhaps that's one thing, but I place very heavy emphasis on the fact that these people are here only because our government caused it to happen that they have no home, and they can't even live in the place where they have lived for all these centuries. And that's why I think their situation calls for absolutely maximum slack cutting. They've got to be helped. They've got to be shown how they can accommodate themselves as far as possible to our way of doing things. But they've also got to be allowed to go their own way as much as is possible. Finally, I mentioned the case now. It was in the newspaper again this morning of Kennewick Man. Kennewick Man is a fossilized skeleton washed out of a riverbank in the Columbia River in Washington, I think 2 years ago, maybe a little longer now. He was, the remains of this man were were sent to a medical examiner. Obviously, the first thought was maybe a murder or drowning victim. but turned out, no. Well, it may have been a murder or drowning victim, but not a recent one. The remarkable thing about that skeleton is that it's 9,300 years old. That was the first discovery. The second, which probably happened before the first, was that the skeleton exhibits Caucasoid structural features, as opposed to the Mongoloid features, which are the structural features of Native Americans. And so this guy is a very interesting person, 9,300 years old and Caucasoid. Well, archaeologists, of course, went ballistic over this. This is a very, very important find. At the same time, the Umatilla Indian tribe and five others, upon discovering what had happened, immediately claimed the remains of this man as ancestral Indian remains and demanded that they be turned over to the tribes for proper burial on the ground that there is a federal law prohibiting the disturbing of Indian graves and requiring the return of Indian remains to tribes. And these people said, this man is our ancestor. We know that because we have our history. It has been revealed to us that our people have been here forever. We also know that we didn't always look the way we look now. And therefore, clearly, this man is one of our ancestors, and you Anglos have no right to him. Also, there's further beliefs about what amounts to corpse desecration. And many of these people have very strong feelings about any sort of experimentation on human remains, appropriation of remains. Well, that fight, as far as I know, is up in the air. The remains of Kennewick Man, to my knowledge, are still in a vault controlled by the Army Corps of Engineers while this issue gets fought out in the courts. Here again, I'm inclined, this looks to me like an absolutely straight-out conflict between religion and science. But let me add one more bit. Kennewick Man died with a piece of a spear point in his hip. He wasn't killed by that spear point. It was healed into his hip. So he'd had a little encounter with somebody somewhere along the way. But the Native Americans, take that as further evidence that he is an ancestral Native American. I think that probably doesn't work very well. I think he may have been a missionary. But you see, they are absolutely convinced. The gods have told them. They've been there forever. He's one of them. And science says it isn't so. Here again, I think this case is enormously complicated. Not because of the merits of the issue. One might think about doing a nice liberal compromise and figuring out some way of sort of doing a minimal disturbance, like remember they did a little radiocarbon dating on one little bit of the Shroud of Turin. But I think the case is complicated by the history of depredations against Native Americans by Anglo culture. And it doesn't seem to me there's any easy way out of this one, even if one thinks, as I do, that the Native American claims in this case are pretty obviously false. They're just mistaken. But then I don't share that religious perspective, right? And I don't have the confidence that they have in what the gods have told them about their origins. So I think we're just going to have to walk slowly. I hope that we are not going to end up losing the scientific knowledge that could come out of the really careful study of Kennewick Man. But I think the situation of race relations in the United States is so bad, and the history is so horrendous, that it might be necessary to give that up out of respect for the deep diversity of human religious beliefs. So I don't think we have to worry too much about whether the Mormons are the real Christians or the Baptists are the real Christians. Maybe they're neither one of them is the real Christians, and maybe there aren't any real Christians. But I think we do have to look very, very carefully at these issues, which I've called issues of deep divergence, and get serious about trying to solve them. Thank you.
Very, very much. Now, we want to have some questions from the audience. If there are some that have occurred to you as you've listened to Dr. Appleby, well, I would like to have you raise them at this time.
Well, Blake's perception, which I think is correct, is that an awful lot of our understanding, moral, legal understanding, precisely proceeds out of our religious convictions. And if you particularly take an issue like abortion, which looks like a pretty straightforwardly religious issue, I mean, you can say one way of looking at this at rock bottom. Question is, when do you, as a matter of religious conviction, believe that you have a human life? And some people believe that you have a human life as soon as there is conception. And if you do, then destroying that life is something like, or maybe not even something like, is homicide. It may not be murder, but it's homicide. And so you have a straightforward reasoning from a religious conviction to an obvious piece of policy. Well, how are you going to negotiate that? I don't have any simple answer to this. I mean, suppose I hold a different view. My view is that you only have a human life when he's graduated from law school. Up to that time, abortion is permissible. What I'm trying to suggest is quite fundamentally conflicting rights. And there are situations in which we do make, I think, quite horrible or horrific Solomonic choices about conflicts of interests. And suppose we do say that a fetus is, maybe we're not going to give away the whole thing here, but a being which certainly has interests. then we've got to start thinking about trying to write policy on the basis of conflicts between those interests and, say, the interests of the mother. And I admit my thinking about this is not clear. I happen to be a pro-choice person, but at the same time, I'm a person who's concerned about fetal alcohol syndrome. And I'm inclined to say you don't have the rights of persons here when you're talking about very small, very early fetuses. On the other hand, I'm sort of inclined to want to have the law intervene when somebody's drinking heavily if she's pregnant. So I'm my own fuser, but what I'm trying to do is get around this procedurally and say, okay, even if we admit there are legitimate interests here, and I do think that there are legitimate interests of fetuses, then we got to still recognize that there are cases of conflict among rights. Where you got to choose? Where you choose? Oh yeah. I'm a little unclear about motivation, the relation of motivation to the sort of content. Let me do a little Thomistic scholasticism here. I think that there are all kinds of ways of deriving moral doctrines. Thomas says that, say, we have the divine revelation that gives us Ten Commandments. He also thinks it's not necessary that we have divine revelation to have the Ten Commandments. We can figure that out ourselves. It's the Ten Commandments are what are crudely required for human flourishing. Where I want to start is to say, look, you and I, no matter where we get these convictions, have a number of moral convictions in common. We think, by and large, people ought not to deceive each other. We think, by and large, that people ought not to take things that don't belong to themselves. We think, by and large, that people ought not to assault each other or kill each other. I mean, everybody believes this. We may not agree about whose people. The abortion thing is a case in point. And we didn't used to believe that. We took a long time about putting the whole human community into the moral franchise. I mean, the common sense moral rules that I rely on have often been restricted in their application. Right? People should treat one another with respect. Everybody believes that. We do sometimes disagree about who counts as a human being. I mean, we didn't used to think that black people were people, so they didn't have to have any respect. And there's been some controversy here about, you know, whether we can have respect for human beings and still lay down the edict that wives ought to graciously obey their husbands. Depends. That seems to me to be a rather peculiar notion. But my point is, look, we all agree you shouldn't kill people. We have a difference of opinion about what counts as a person, right? in, say, the immediate result of conception. I don't think that's a person. Maybe you do. But I do think that the destruction at whatever stage of human life is a very, very serious matter. And so if I'm going to push, as I will, the idea that that women ought to have the right to decide in this matter, I'm going to try to do that on some common ground that I have with you. And the way this debate has gone, of course, has been rather peculiar. Because, for instance, even the people who are strongly inclined to say abortion is something like murder, or leave out the something like, abortion is murder, have been willing to make exceptions in the cases of rape and incest. To which I would want to say, why? because we don't like what your daddy did, we're going to kill you? No. So I see the sense of Blake's views about how we get our moral convictions, how we get our legal institutions. But I'm willing to say, all right, let's take what we got and see if we can negotiate these issues procedurally. Yeah. The comment has to do with the rhetoric and the way that we approach these issues, and I think it's correct to say that, particularly, well, I don't like the abortion issue because there's so much hot air. It's an issue about which it seems many of us stopped thinking 10 years ago. And started drawing lines, I think it's very hard to get a sort of intelligent conversation. The suggestion is maybe it's best to have a religion neutral rhetoric in which to discuss these things, and I think there's some truth in that. Though I think it's perfectly appropriate for people to exhibit their religious colors in public discourse. I don't share the view that we should sort of say nothing about our religion when we're talking about public matters. I do think, however, that what we've got to do is to find non-sectarian grounds for solving these problems. I think there's nothing wrong whatsoever with saying, here I am to participate in this public discussion, and I represent the Mormon Church or whatever it is. I'm here to advocate this position. Where I think things go very badly wrong is when somebody starts trying to draw lines that divide the group in such a way that my saying that I represent this group means that I'm putting you on notice that I think you're a bad person. and I think that's where things really degenerate fast. Yeah. Well, the question has to do with what happens now. I talked about the case of a Muslim family coming to the United States. what happens now if we are a Mormon family and find ourselves, say, in Egypt, where female circumcision is practiced? I'm not sure. You know, I guess what happens is that if anybody offers to practice that on your kids, you're on the next plane out. But I certainly do think that, in large measure, if you are a visitor in a foreign country, you do what they do. Female circumcision thing is so horrendous. I don't know upon whom this is imposed, and I don't suppose it's imposed on Christian family. I just don't know. Well, would there be something, the point has to do with the ubiquity of the practice of abortion in Russia, undoubtedly in China as well, and now numbers of people in Russia are becoming Mormons. What should be the stance of their religious leaders in Russia? I suppose, again, I don't know, but I suppose that that the position would be to say, we Mormons don't do that, and we strongly encourage you not to do it. Now, I don't know what would happen if... Is that an excommunication offense? I mean, see, again, I suppose that if I were a bishop, maybe I shouldn't say this writing home, but I'd want to cut him some slack. I always remember a time when I hosted, my wife and I hosted a cocktail party, and there was a neighbor of ours who came, she and her husband. I offered her various kinds of juice and ginger ale, and she said she'd like a whiskey sour. And I said, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to be inhospitable, but I thought you were LDS. And she said, yes, she was LDS, but she couldn't believe that the good Lord minded a little whiskey sour. You know? And I hope she was right about that. Little whiskey sour is quite good, but especially the ones I make, I might add. But I don't know. I mean, if one hears folkloric tales about Scandinavian Mormons giving up coffee, and I hope nobody makes too much of a fuss about coffee for Scandinavian Mormons. This is, I mean, it's one thing to demand of somebody. So suppose I say, okay, I've just had a revelation. No more eating liver. Okay? You're all going to praise the Lord. There's probably not two people in the room who likes to eat liver, right? But suppose you grew up on coffee. I mean, well, I don't know. I don't write the rules. But it seems to me that if that is embedded in the culture, that you wouldn't respond to it in just the way that you would maybe in Utah. I don't know. Yeah, sir. Well, certainly it is true. The comment is that to understand these issues, we need to dig into the history of the customs, the practices, learn where they came from, and do a much better job of what Blake was talking about earlier, understanding where our ideas about these matters came from. And then, of course, also respecting the experience of other people. And I agree with that, with that comment altogether. I mean, there's an awful lot about the way that we do things which can be illuminated by some understanding of the history of our own practices. And some of that is going to be a very sort of uplifting religious history. Some of it's not going to be so uplifting at all. It's going to be discourse about sort of political trade-offs in one thing or another. But I think it can be very illuminating, and I do not mean to suggest that we should not sort of show our hands about where our beliefs come from and what our point of view is. I also think that, well, as with the case of prohibiting liver versus prohibiting coffee, one needs to be extremely careful about passing judgment on the exigencies of the experience of other people. And of course, the abortion issue is the sort of central case here. Voices of people like me should not be the principal voices in that discussion, right? Because that's not my problem, is it? In an ancillary way, it could be, but I do think that people are correct in saying, if there is no chance that this could be a problem that you face, then you ought to be very careful about solving it for somebody else. I think that's right.
One more comment?
Yes, please. Yeah.
something I do not know. I would both sides identify their assumptions, and then the assumptions under the assumptions. We always start at too high a level. We're always saying that this is right and this is wrong. So let's get below that. And neither side does that, and that's what I know.
Yeah, there is the whole conflict about, I take it the center of the conflict is when does life begin, and that's not even right. When do you have a human being? That's the question. Not when does life begin, but when do you have a human being? And I take it that that is a matter of divine revelation. And that's the way I tried to frame the debate was in terms of sort of conflict, conflicting interests. Yeah.
I wonder if there isn't an element in this situation as well that relates to the quite common circumstance. For instance, abortion in China.
Yeah.
They have a very significant social and the amount of concern that we need to give to them, what you might call a pragmatic aspect. When you think of it in terms of the religious aspect, of course it's that historical. Always, every society throughout the history of man has brought to man different concepts of what value ought to be based upon economics, based upon weather events, based upon all kinds of diverse factors they had to consider in the process of survival. And as a result, they've integrated a tremendous number of different kinds of taboos and different kinds of value systems. And so when do you draw the line when you say, okay, let's talk about abortion? How much of it is rooted in religion because of the need for clans to exist, the needs for people to survive economically, the needs to bear children to go over an extended period of time in order to survive, as related, and therefore abortion is horrible, as related to another aspect or a more basic, which Dr. Appleby referred to, which was pragmatic. Pragmatic dominance. When does it become truly destructive to the society as a whole to have more children? When does it become destructive to the society, to the individual, to have more children? And how does that relate to religious values in terms of the well-being and the ultimate happiness, fulfillment, growth, progress of this individual as an individual? And so we have to balance out somewhere, where is it truly religious? Where does it really come back to some kind of pragmatic decision as to the benefit of society as a whole? I didn't mean that.
Well, you know, we do have this pragmatic genius. I started out with the observation, this business about quiet religion. We really do believe that our beliefs are right. Right? That is, Mormons are very likely to believe that the LDS faith is the true religion. Baptists, the same. We also believe that we ought to tolerate other people. Now, it's not quite clear why we believe that, but there are a lot of plausible reasons why we should. But it opens the possibility of making a deal. Let me close with one example about patterns of religious thought that I just think is marvelous. It's a kind of modern-day miracle. About 10 years ago, the Gallup people took a poll among American Catholics in which it was revealed that close to 90% of American Catholics continue to believe that the Pope is infallible when he speaks ex cathedra on matters of faith and morals. That's the standard belief. 65% of those people, the same people, reserve the right to disagree with it. Now, there's got to be hope, you see. There's got to be hope. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you all for coming and your participation. We appreciate your being here. Now, we're dismissed.